Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is Dr. Kelly Bulkley. Dr. Bulkley is a dream researcher and a visiting scholar at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. Dr. Bulkley and I will be discussing his latest book, Children's Dream, Understanding the Most Memorable Dreams and Nightmares of Childhood. Good morning, Dr. Bulkley. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on your show.
Fantastic. It is a pleasure to have you on the air. Children's Dream is a very interesting book. It is very well written, and it makes a wonderful reference book for the family. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate hearing that.
Wonderful. Let's start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Well, sure. I've grown up in the Bay Area of California and was very interested in sports and wanted to be a baseball player or maybe a lawyer or business person. Until middle of my teenage years, I started noticing some dreams that I was having, recurrent nightmares of being chased or attacked. And everything that I tried to do in the dreams, whether it was running away or fighting or trying to talk my way out of it, none of it worked. I always ended the dream in just terror and fear. And mm-hmm. I started thinking, what could be causing those dreams? Everything that I'm good at in the waking world seems useless in these dreams. And mm-hmm. so I started reading some books about dreams and talking to some people and realized that, wow, some of these dreams were kind of revealing aspects of myself that I wasn't familiar with and I hadn't really known before. And once mm-hmm. I kind of made that connection, the dreams started changing and new things started happening. So that's kind of how I first got fascinated with the subject, was mm-hmm. kind mm-hmm. of being, you know, directed away from where I was going in life and, mm-hmm. and opening mm-hmm. this whole other dimension of my consciousness. And so I went on to school and studied psychology and philosophy and religion and anything that could teach me about dreams. And here I am, having written some books on the subject and doing some teaching and such, and still just fascinated by the potential of dreams to open up things that we've never known before, never thought about before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Of course, your book talks about the many different aspects of dreams. In this case, you were talking about the scary stuff that you were dreaming about. And of course, some people dream about wonderful things. So your experience as a child when you were dreaming all this so-called scary stuff. I remember when I was growing up, I would dream scary stuff because I was watching Dracula.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I watched a lot of scary movies like that too, so that was definitely part of it.
What is a dream?
Well, a dream, the shortest definition I give for dreaming is imaginative play in sleep. So mm-hmm. I think of dreaming as when our minds are sort of withdrawn from the external world, we play. We're mm-hmm. sort of free. Mm-hmm. We don't have to do anything in particular, and so we can imagine things that are both fun and things that are scary, things that concern us or mm-hmm. worry us. And so dreams are a way the mind explores the different things it's experienced during the day, there in previous days, and tries to make sense of them and gets us ready for the next day.
What's interesting about your book is you spent some time talking about brain science. So let's just talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about the neocortex and so forth. Explain to us a little bit more about that. I think a lot of people are fascinated about dreams, but at the same time, they're also fascinated about how that sort of being processed by our brain, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's really a fascinating story that's emerged in recent years about how the human brain develops and all the different abilities we have and how they're rooted in mm-hmm. aspects of the way the brain works. And one of the big discoveries has been that when we go to sleep at night, the brain doesn't just shut off.
you know, that actually there's this very complex cycle of activities that occurs during sleep, and that's when our dreams emerge. And sometimes when we're asleep, the brain is as active in terms of sort of its electrical energy mm-hmm. as when we're fully awake. And so that tells you that when we're asleep, you know, the brain is doing things and like I said, processing our experiences, imagining different possibilities, giving us some anticipations of how our development is going to unfold. And so, you know, the parts of the brain, it's the neocortex, which is kind of the more, you know, kind of where consciousness tends to be connected with different parts of that brain region. There's also the limbic system, which is where mm-hmm. Emotions and sort of instinctual fight-flight sort of activities are often located. And then what's called the sort of the visual cortex, the part of the brain that's responsible for vision. Even though our eyes are closed when we're asleep, the visual processing parts of our brain are really active. And I think that's such a cool finding of brain science, because it really fits with our experiences of dreams, that we are in these visually super realistic worlds, and yet our eyes are completely closed and we're lying in the dark, you know. And so
Right. Brain
research is validating this idea that, yeah, when we're asleep and dreaming, we are visually creating these amazing worlds.
That's fantastic. Is it healthy to have dreams?
Yeah, with the caveat that dream recall is quite variable, and so mm-hmm. some people remember lots of dreams, other people don't remember barely any dreams. Dreaming itself is a normal, natural, healthy part of being human, but mm-hmm. people really vary in how much of their dreams they remember. So,
no, that's true, because you just seem to not able to recall things. I know for myself, I'm not able to recall things that I dream about, and it's very difficult to journal afterwards.
Yeah, well, and I guess I'd say that, you know, we're all forgetting the vast mm-hmm. majority of those activities of our, you know, mind-brain system during the night. And I have to believe that's okay, that mm-hmm. remember, when we remember dreams and consciously reflect on them, that's kind of a added bonus, and good mm-hmm. things can come from that. But you don't have to worry about the dreams you're not remembering, because, well, you know, they're doing their thing. You can trust that.
Interesting. Is having a nightmare just a dark dream?
Well, nightmares have many different sources and sort of potential causes. I mean, the mm-hmm. the dreams mm-hmm. that I talked about that kind of got me interested in the whole subject back when I was a teenager, I would call those shadow nightmares, meaning that mm-hmm. they were nightmares that revealed aspects of what Carl Jung called the shadow side of ourselves, sort of the mm-hmm. underdeveloped, unrecognized parts of who we are. And those kinds of nightmares are related to, you know, more sort of internally. Now, there are nightmares caused by, yeah, like watching a super scary mm-hmm. movie, or, you know, or even worse, you know, like an external trauma of some kind, an accident or an assault mm-hmm. or something like that. And that's a different kind of nightmare source. So, you know, it really depends. And from a, you know, a parent's perspective, I think, you know, you always have to be on the lookout for things that are, you know, in the external world that are, you know, troubling or worrying your children. Mm-hmm. But also be ready for just kind of the natural growth process that all children go through within themselves, that's probably more often than not going to generate some nightmares just as they grow up, just kind of as a part of, you know, the challenges of that process.
Wonderful. What is the inspiration behind Children's Dream?
Well, my brother and I wrote this book after this is the second book we've written. We 6 years ago, I guess now, we co-wrote a book called Dreaming Beyond Death, mm-hmm. A Guide to Pre-Death Dreams and Visions. And that was based on my mother's a former hospice chaplain and spiritual mm-hmm. services provider, and worked for many years with people who were in their final weeks, days, and hours of life, and learned a lot about their dreams and visions. And so we wrote a book about that mm-hmm. and really enjoyed it. But it was also, you know, everybody we were talking about were people who were dying, you know, and their families and
yeah.
friends. And so it was kind of a, end of life type of book, and we thought, wouldn't it be fun to write something, you know, a little more lighthearted and a little more upbeat? And we thought, well, what about the, you know, kind of as a complement to the dreams at the end of life, to write a book about the dreams at the beginning of life? You know, so early childhood dreams seemed like an interesting topic to kind of explore using the same psychology and religion and spirituality approach that we used in that first book.
Very interesting. So how did your mom get involved with this book itself?
Yeah, well, she and I, we read very carefully this new translation of the psychologist Carl Jung. He taught a seminar on the subject of children's dreams back in the 1930s, and it's a very obscure text, but there's a new translation, and it's just fascinating. And so we read that book very, very carefully and really looked at every one of the dreams that Jung analyzed and his ideas about it, and thought, you know, if there is a way to convey some of these insights into language that, you know, ordinary parents today could make use of, that could be really helpful. So she and I just kind of worked our way through it, gathered dreams from family and friends and clients and historical sources and such, and, put it together.
Interesting. Well, I mean, his stuff is really so much ahead of time. And it's quite interesting about how he analyzes the dream aspects of it and so forth. Can you share with us Jung's analysis dream report process?
Yeah, well, Jung, in a certain way, saw dreams as a little play, like a dramatic performance that your mind creates for you. And so he thought that you could start an analysis of a dream by looking at first kind of what's the setting, you know, just like at a play, like what's the setting, you know, what's the time and the place, and then look at secondly at kind of what's happening, like who are the characters, what are they, you know, how do you first see them, and then third he said look at how the plot develops, like kind of what happens, how does the action unfold? There's usually, you know, kind of the setting and then the unfolding. And then finally, you know, how does the dream end? Is there an ending? Does it just sort of abruptly cut off, or is there a resolution of some kind? And he said if you start by just very simply, you know, laying out the elements of the dream in those kind of dramatic terms, it kind of helps you get oriented and you start to see some connections with you know, if it's a children's dream with a child's life and things going on, and you kind of go from there.
Interesting. When do children start dreaming?
Well, that's a controversial question because we don't know before children can tell us about their dreams, if they've been dreaming or not. In other words, you know, are babies dreaming even if they can't tell us about them? And I tend to think that the mind is, you know, doing its thing in sleep even at that early age. And so I think that dreaming begins, you know, pretty much at the beginning of life. And it emerges more fully as we're able to, as we grow up and our brains and minds mature. You know, most parents are going to hear their children say something, you know, I saw something when I was asleep, or, you know, they'll tell a little dream story, probably around the ages of 2, 3, 4 years old, maybe, you know, that's typical. So, you know, kind of as they start to gain some, like I said, some linguistic ability to share their experiences.
Dream is also associated with REM sleep. This is quite interesting. In your book, you sort of explain about the correlation in terms of the percentage of REM sleeps happen more in a child than in adults, correct?
Yeah, and that I think is a really important fact for parents to know, is that dream researchers, we believe that dreaming is very closely associated with REM sleep. It's not sort of a one-to-one direct thing, but it's very closely related. Well, it turns out that children spend 50, 60, 70% of their sleep cycle in REM sleep. This is, you know, very young children, infants and you know, first couple years of life. And then as adults, we're down to 20 or 25% in many cases. So there's a lot of REM sleep going on early in life, right when the brain is developing, right when the, you know, kind of a young human mind is forming. And it certainly seems like dreaming is part of that kind of overall brain development process. And so, you know, I think from a parenting point of view, it's a reason to not only take dreaming seriously, but to take children's sleep very seriously and to really think about how you can best create a, you know, a safe, secure, and comfortable sleep environment for your child, because it's so good for them at that early stage of life.
Speaking about environment, does environment contribute to a children's dream in the sense that we talk about growing up, you and I will be watching Dracula, and of course, at night, let's just say we'll be having our nightmare, so to speak. So how much does environment plays in with dreams?
Yeah. It plays a bigger and bigger role as children get older. There'll be more references to, sort of outside, whether it's movies or TV or action figures or things like that. The older children get, and that's kind of natural as they get older. I think what parents can look for are the external kind of environmental influences, are they kind of dominating? You know, is a child like only dreaming about being in a video game, say, or something like that? But in many cases, what children, if you look at those dreams, dreaming is a kind of play. And so what children seem to do many times is take in the external cultural influences or figures and kind of weave a new story around them. So it may not, I mean, I don't know about your Dracula dreams, but in my case, it wasn't that I was in that movie, but that Dracula, like I was doing things and Dracula was part of it. And it was like I had drawn, my mind had taken the Dracula figure in, but was playing with it, was kind of experimenting with it and trying different things. So I think from a parent's point of view, you definitely want to, you know, notice those things and kind of, you know, keep track of what your child's taking in, but also notice how your child is using those environmental influences. You know, parents sometimes think, I can't let these bad things harm, you know, influence my child or do things to my child. I think children a lot of times use culture in a more active, creative way. So that's something you can see in their dreams.
Interesting. Why is this missing a child's dream can be bad for the child?
Well, parents sometimes when, you know, you have that middle-of-the-night situation and your child is woken up with a bad dream, you want to do everything you can to comfort them and reassure them and make them feel okay again. But it's easy to slip into that process, the idea that, it was just a dream. You know, it wasn't real. Don't be scared because it wasn't real. And and the idea that we try to get across in this book is that you can provide all the comfort and reassurance your child needs without necessarily saying that, because dreams are real. They're emotionally real, and while you're in the dream, it's real. And children, I think when they hear parents saying, dreams aren't real, don't pay attention to them, I think they just hear, I can't talk about this with my parents. And, you know, I'm kind of stuck with this now. And we think a better approach is to, you know, acknowledge that, dreams have an emotional power. They have a visual intensity sometimes that can be very overwhelming. But if we, you know, the next day, the next morning, you know, a couple days later, if that makes sense, to talk about those dreams, the child can not only learn from them, but learn to overcome something that seemed initially scary and frightening, and something that they can then learn, that's part of me. That's something that my mind created, and now I can look at and reflect on. And not that you say that sort of analytically, but just in the sense of just parents asking their children about what happened. Can you draw me a picture of that? How could the dream have ended differently? What might you do if the dream came again? Just by asking really simple questions, parents can keep open this idea that, hey, you have this amazing creative imagination in your sleep each night. Like that's a good thing, not something to dismiss and just to say, oh, that's not real.
Right. I enjoyed reading your book, the section about emotions, because I talk about things to people in terms of when we look at things, when we make decisions, we often use either the heart or the mind. And of course, the mind is very absolute and so forth. And of course, the heart tends to be tied to emotions and everything else. But what's interesting here is that the neuroscientists found emotions are actually sophisticated expression of mental analysis and evaluation. And I thought that, yeah, that's great.
Yeah. No, that's a really important finding of recent brain science is that, emotions are not kind of primitive thinking that really we'd be better off. You know, we'd be better if we were all Mr. Spock. You know, we could just sort of just think without any emotions. But actually thinking and emotion kind of all go together. And emotions reflect a really sophisticated network of brain activities that pull together our perceptions and our memories and our all of our senses. Emotions are wonderful things, and in some ways that's where I think people who are kind of new to the subject of dreams can really find the best entry into their meaning is by focusing on the emotions, because dreams can have crazy images and settings and all sorts of wild stuff going on that doesn't seem to have any connection to regular waking life. But usually the emotions in dreams have some parallel with emotions in waking life. And so if you start with, you know, where, like if you have a scary dream, well, okay, where am I feeling similar kinds of, you know, anxiety? Maybe not as dramatically as in the dream, because that's dreams are, you know, they love to exaggerate and you know, like I said, play at them. But looking for those emotional connections, I think, is a really good way to get started in learning about your own dreams.
You mentioned just now about emotional intelligence. How does emotional intelligence relate to early childhood education?
Yeah, well, I think that emotional intelligence in some ways, and I can say this, you know, being a father and having raised three kids, just seeing how different emotional intelligence is from like just learning math or history or how to write an essay. You know, there's something about that comes from interacting with other people and reflecting on people's behaviors and motivations and what people, you know, are interested in and what they fear. It's a very subtle thing, and yet vital to I think, you know, our success and fulfillment later in life. So in early childhood, I think a lot of, you know, where dreams can play a role in that is, again, in serving as a source of kind of an emotional mirror. You know, dreams reflect back our feelings in different situations. And by sharing dreams, by talking about them, and this, you know, in a family context, I think can be a really wonderful resource. You know, you can do nothing more than, you know, at the breakfast table say, oh, I had this funny dream about such and such. And your child might say, huh, well, you know, I had a dream about such and such. And you might say nothing more than that, but you just had a really profound emotional communication. And the deeper parts of your mind are going to hear each other's dreams and process that and take that into account. And I think that begins to build the foundation for, you know, kind of a lifelong fluency with emotions and with interpersonal relations.
You just touched on something very interesting. It's true. By just merely doing that, just the ability to listen to your child expressing his or her dreams, it's sort of a validation of I matter.
Yeah. This is thanks for bringing that up or pointing that out, because you know, one thing we really try to get across in the book is that you don't to derive, you know, a lot of benefits from children's dreams. You don't have to interpret them. You don't have to necessarily analyze them. Doing nothing more than just listening and asking some questions and being open to
your child's dreaming imagination. Just like you say, that is such a powerful validation for the child, him or herself, that, wow, I matter. My dreams matter. That, I mean, that's a gift. That's a lifelong gift. And so, yeah, just right there, I think you don't have to pretend to be Dr. Freud or Dr. Jung. You
right,
can just be a parent like you are in all other circumstances, and this will happen.
Interesting. What are some of the typical themes of children's dreams?
Yeah, well, on the scarier end of things, you know, there's a fair amount of dreams that children will have about being separated from their family, whether, you know, bad things happen to their parents or the child is kidnapped or lost or something like that. Those kinds of themes recur fairly often and, you know, naturally reflect, you know, most children imagine, like, wow, it would be a real bummer if I got separated from my parents. That wouldn't be a good thing. And so a lot of dreams about that. But then kind of on the happier side, children have more flying dreams, it seems, than adults do. So a fair amount of flying. They have lots of animals in their dreams, more so than do adults, which is, I think, an interesting thing, you know. Some people say, "Oh, well, that's because children are closer to being animals. You know, they're closer to animal life." Yeah, that could be. You know, other people say, "Well, look at any kid's room, and they've got, you know, 20 stuffed animals, and you know, they read every children's story is about an animal." So, that could be part, like you said, kind of the environment, kind of the culture of childhood. I've noticed, you know, we describe a couple examples in the book. Some examples of fire in children's dreams, where that the element of fire and water dreams too. So those two elements, often in a threatening manner, you know, fire burning a house or a building or being caught in a fire, and likewise with water, like being you know, waves and oceans and floods and things like that. So, you know, this, I think, at a very deep instinctual level is just, you know, young children they're kind of entering human existence. And, yeah, for millions of years, humans have had to deal with the dangers of fire and water. So get ready. You know, that's the way I think of those dreams.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I remember now when I was growing up, one of the dreams in terms of, well, like, say, the fun side or the fear side, I always dream about drowning in some ways, in the sense that I'm overwhelmed by all these volumes and volumes of water. And I can relate to the fact that, well, till this day, I can't really swim very well because my mom does not want me to swim. And the reason is because when we were growing up, kids, as you know, behaved badly. There were kids that were drowned because friends, in the course of playing in the pool or by the sea and all that kind of stuff, do stupid things, of course. And so my mom forbid my sister and I to play with water from that aspect of going out swimming with friends and so forth. And so I would have dreams about being just overwhelmed with so much water.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, it's a really scary thing. And you know, a lot of childhood, you know, anxieties, you know, get really amplified in dreams. And yeah, you're not crazy for that. That's a really, lot of children have those kinds of dreams. And it's interesting because, in sleep, there's sometimes, you know, we have breathing issues, you know, like sleep apnea is a fairly common sleep disorder. And even in childhood, sometimes there's anxieties about getting enough breath while you're sleeping. So, you know, a dream like what you're describing, you know, kind of may combine kind of the physical experience of troubled sleep with this, you know, symbolic theme of water and parental anxiety and and just the element of water, sort of the overwhelming, you know, as a kid, you look at the ocean and you just start thinking, wow, that's so big and I'm so little. You know, that's a lot of the dreams we talk about in this book. We kind of point out, you know, it may be about something going on with a child at home or at school or something, but it's also, there's some deep philosophical and kind of existential issues that come up in children's dreams that it's not so much that we have an answer for them, it's just, wow, that's an early glimpse of a deeper truth, you know, that often happens in children's dreams.
Well, your book mentioned about the fact that when you dream about things like that, it sort of prepares us for the danger in real life. So one of the things I could relate to is that for me, whenever I'm around a body of water, I have a sense of respect and different sense of appreciation and that kind of thing, rather than just being sort of a, hey, as a kid, I'm happy-go-lucky, who cares, and all that kind of stuff, but just have a different sense of appreciation and respect for the
Yeah, hour. Yeah. And that's what I've, thanks for bringing that up, because that's a really important point, I think, in appreciating what function dreams serve in life and what some researchers call is threat simulation. And just as you say, sort of a dream will portray a certain kind of danger or threat. And then when you wake up, you know, you're relieved that didn't really happen. But
right.
You're also like a little more on your toes the next day, and you're a little more vigilant, and you're a little more sensitive to threats or dangers from that quarter. I mean, I have that kind of, I've had that kind of dream as a parent, you know, where you know, there'll be a threat to one of my children, and you know, they'll fall out of a car, or a wave will carry them away, or something bad will happen, and I wake up and I'm relieved that was a dream. But I'm also, I can't help it, I'm a little more, like I said, vigilant about my child's well-being. And I think there's kind of a natural wisdom to dreams at that level. And you can kind of trust that. Like, okay, my dreams doesn't necessarily mean that what you dream about is going to happen. You know, I don't think it's sort of an automatic prophecy kind of thing. But, you know, your mind is kind of anticipating and thinking about the odds and, you know, what might happen. And, you know, that can't be a bad thing, I'd say.
I agree. Do children have more nightmares than adults?
Well, it does seem that as a, you know, sort of frequency matter, children have more bad dreams, disturbing dreams than do adults. Children tend to, you know, are willing to talk about their dreams a little more readily than adults. So, you know, that may be a factor. But it does seem that, based on the idea that often bad dreams are part of a process of change or dealing with new, you know, unexpected developments in life, that's happening all the time to children in a way that it's not happening. You know, adults' lives sort of settle down a little more predictable, a little more control over their circumstances. And so it makes sense that young children are going to dream more often of being vulnerable and exposed and incapable of dealing with problems, because that's an accurate reflection of where they stand in the big scheme of things. So yeah, that's true, and yet it's also kind of, to me, not something to worry about. It's just kind of natural to growing up.
What can parents do to comfort a child who has had a nightmare?
Well, it's like I said earlier, it's kind of a classic parenting moment. You know, it's the middle of the night and you're kind of bleary yourself. And I think the most important thing is to reassure the child that that they're awake now, the dream is over, and you know, whatever it takes in terms of, you know, maybe getting out of bed, you know, if the child wants to look under the bed or in the closet or something, just make sure it's all good. I think that that's as much as really, I'm not sure I'd really get into a big conversation about the bad dream at that moment. I tend to think, like, reassure the child, help him or her get comfortable again. And often, you know, they'll just conk right out and go right back to sleep. I mean, that's, you know, sometimes they're up for longer, but sometimes it's just like they just needed that reassurance and then back out they go. What I think is important is, you know, the next morning, the next day, whenever you get a chance, checking back with your child about that dream and just, you know, again, not necessarily analyzing it, you know, in minute detail, but just like what were kind of the sort of key points or details? What were the weirdest aspects of it? What might you do differently if it ever happened again? I think a little bit of that kind of conversation can really help a child feel that, you know, I had the nightmare rather than the nightmare had me.
Right.
And I think that's the shift you want to help your child kind of make is rather than, wow, I'm completely consumed by the fear and the images of the nightmare, it's, wow, I can bring those feelings and images out into a conversation with my parent. I can draw a picture of it. I can talk about it. I think that helps diminish sort of the deep anxiety that these dreams can bring, and opens up the possibility for maybe learning something, gaining some insight.
It's a process of transference.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. How about reoccurring dreams?
Yeah, well, most people, and you know, if you ask people, they'll often mention a certain dream theme or scenario that has come, you know, in many dreams through their lives. There's kind of, you know, many people, it's almost like your own kind of dream companion, you know, kind of the thing that follows you through life, and they often start in childhood. And so I think with recurrent dreams, I mean, sometimes it can be a very specific thing, like, you know, recurrent around a particular issue, and once you kind of resolve that issue, the recurrent dreams sort of stop or you know, diminish or go away. Other times, recurrent dreams are just kind of your template for experiencing life. I mean, simple example from my experience, you know, I've had sports dreams through my life. I played a lot of sports as a kid, and I got used to looking at certain aspects of life through the lens of a sporting activity. And so even now, even though I don't play any, you know, competitive sports now, I still from time to time have dreams where I'm back playing in some kind of game. And what it seems to be doing is taking my kind of current life issues and framing them in that recurrent setting, which is a way I've always kind of made sense of things. And so I think for people who have recurrent dreams that have gone on through their lives, I think that's often what's happening. It's kind of their comfortable way of, you know, making sense of things and looking at how current experiences match up with the way they've you know, gone about life before.
How does sleep pattern correlates with dreaming?
Well, the typical night's sleep involves, we've already talked about REM sleep, and as well, there are non-REM stages of sleep. And it seems that the most of the non-REM sleeping happens at the first part of the night, and so there's relatively less dream recall coming kind of the first half of the night. There tends to be much more REM sleep the second half of the night, and so that's often when you may be more likely to remember dreaming, particularly right when you wake up and you're just kind of making that transition. So it seems that we're, like I said, the mind is active and doing things all through the night, so probably if, you know, in a sleep lab you woke someone up at any particular point, you would be able to get some kind of dream little tidbit out of them. But it's much more likely towards the end of the night, towards morning, when REM sleep seems to be the most, you know, prevalent in the sleep cycle.
Do you recommend dream journaling as part of child development process?
Yeah, I do, and I think there's a couple of stages that you can go through with it. To begin with, you know, with very young children who, you know, can't you know, write yet, you know, the parent might be sort of the scribe, the dream scribe in the morning, and just, you know, having a pad of paper and a pen. And you know, if it's a journal, the child may, is what I do with my kids. I, you know, I had them draw pictures on the cover and, you know, do some drawings inside while I would write out the dreams. Later on, they can write out the dreams themselves. And I think the value is that it kind of keeps kids, you know, in touch with their own unconscious, and
it's kind of like keeping a diary. You know, any of the benefits that come with a diary are kind of the same with dream journaling, and you know, that again creates this idea that you know, each of us is a dreamer and a lifelong dreamer, and you know, if you can form a good relationship with that part of yourself early in life, then you're gonna benefit from it for the rest of your life.
Very interesting. Was there a surprising discovery you uncovered about dreams in your research?
Well, it's all surprising. Gosh, I mean, every you know, I think that the challenge of dealing with nightmares and bad dreams, I think, is a really you know, like I said, we kind of went into writing the book thinking, oh, this is going to be the lighthearted, upbeat project after the dreams of death. And, you know, a funny way that the dreams preceding death were actually, many of them really were upbeat and kind of anticipating, you know, life beyond death. And many of the children's dreams are actually pretty dark and, you know, anxious about, you know, the tough, you know, good and evil and suffering and, you know, the human mortality and all of that. So I guess that was kind of surprising that, you know, children, I could put it like this, that the children are way more philosophically mature than we give them credit for, that they are in their dreams. And I think in their just kind of private, you know, cogitations, they're thinking about the big, big questions of human life much earlier than we adults, I think, appreciate, and it makes it, I guess I end up respecting that early wisdom of children even more so than I did before.
Interesting. Are dreams of teenagers different from dreams of younger children?
Yeah, in a couple of ways. I mean, they in kind of obvious ways too. I mean, the dreams of teenagers become more complex kind of narratives in terms of, you know, they have more characters, there's more activities, more things going on, which, you know, reflects their greater kind of language abilities and just the fact that they are out and about and doing more than young children. There's also obviously the impact of adolescence and all the physical and psychological and hormonal changes that come with that, and those start, you know, I hate telling parents this if they don't, you know, if they don't want to hear it, but it's, you know, those issues start to emerge even sooner than you would think. I mean, in, you know, children's dreams, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, they're anticipating what they know is about to happen, and and, you know, again, I think dreams are part of the way we adapt to new challenges in life. So I think that's a good thing. But it definitely, dreams become more emotionally complicated, more, you know, sort of instinctually complicated as children get older. And, you know, again, that's part of growing up. It if you've got a good base from earlier in life, from earlier in childhood, and talking about dreams and reflecting on them, I think that when you hit that teenage phase, you know, the dreams are still quite valuable and insightful, but just in that different kind of way. So just to be ready for that is a good thing.
Interesting. Are there any dangers to watch for in children's dreams?
Yeah, well, and it's good to bring this up, at, you know, in a conversation about children's dreams, because, you know, I'm promoting a general idea that dreaming is a natural, normal part of childhood, and even scary dreams can be sources of insight and growth. But it's also important to note that, you know, if a child has, you know, really severe recurrent nightmares, or dreams that are just kind of pervasively, you know, impacting the child's waking, you know, emotion and behavior and sort of mood,
You know, parents should certainly not hesitate to contact their physician or a therapist or, you know, some trusted professional person who can help them assess, you know, are these dreams reflecting something problematic in the child's waking life that you know, maybe we're not aware of. Dreams are usually so symbolically complex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have so many different layers of meaning that, you know, you can't ever get be sure that the literal meaning of a dream is something that's actually happening in the waking world. But
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
you got to be on your toes, and so that would be the danger, I think, would be to dismiss, you know, not pay attention to dreams like that,
right.
And not at least check with a, you know, physician or a therapist or somebody. I think that's, but for the most part, I think you're going to find that danger is not as great as it might appear at the surface. So,
I think it brings back the idea about just having that conversation and validating the child's dream, what he has to say or what she has to express. I think that's the most important thing, and then you can make the determination on which way to go. And of course, this comes back to the idea of whether it's a reoccurring dream or not.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. That if you can have that kind of conversation in the bigger context of already
mm-hmm.
being familiar with the ways of the dreams, then that's going to be an easier judgment to make,
mm-hmm.
Whichever way you have to go. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Your book is written for parents, teachers, therapists, and people who work with children's education. How can your book contribute to these individuals?
Well, we hope that, you know, everything we've been saying, you know,
mm-hmm.
today, you know, makes it, I think, relevant to parents just trying to help their children grow up to be healthy, you know, creative, emotionally self-assured
mm-hmm.
people. And, you know, that kind of radiates out as well into school, I think, where teachers are also trying to find ways to stimulate children's growth, to enhance their creativity and their you know, the whole spectrum of their abilities. And I think that dreaming, you know, we talk about this a bit in the book, you know, is a, it's not even that you have to talk about that, you know, teachers have to be asking their children about their dreams, although there's ways you can do that, but even more simply, just, you know, reading stories about dreams and you know, bringing up dreams as kind of a, you know, a general theme, or talking about how animals sleep and, wow, do animals dream? There's all sorts of ways that teachers can, again, signal to children that dreaming is a normal part of life and
mm-hmm.
something we can learn from. You know, you don't have to be again, pretend to be Dr. Freud and lay them down on the couch and analyze them to, you know, benefit from, you know, bringing the subject up. And I think that what teachers often find, you know, I've talked to several of them, you know, research for the book, is that if you bring the topic of dreams into a classroom, often the kids just love it. You know, they just take right to it. You know, if you give them an art assignment to make a painting of a dream, or you know, make up a story that has a dream as a part of it, children resonate with that and,
mm-hmm.
and delight in it. So, you know, in some ways, our advice to teachers is just, you know, just give it a try, and we're pretty confident you'll find that, you know, interesting things come of it.
Your book talks about Carl Jung's approach to dreams as in terms of big dreams, and of course that relates to creativity and self-confidence. So the bottom line comes down to, if you take time to encourage those things and write down those big dreams, no telling what the child can accomplish down the road, because it is the process of talking about, again, the emotional intelligence being addressed at a very young age to build that child's confidence and everything else that goes with it.
Yeah. That's, you know, in broader terms, the mm-hmm. I think child development, you know, it goes best when there's a kind of a free flow of energy from their kind of their deep human instincts,
mm-hmm.
into their emerging waking consciousness and personality and identity in the world. And you know, again, we can focus on the meanings of particular dreams, but I think the real goal that we had in writing the book was to encourage parents just to consider dreaming as a
mm-hmm.
process, as this feature of a child's life, and just help them feel comfortable and good about that, and
mm-hmm.
able to draw upon it as they get older. And you know, parents may never, you know, kids at a certain point don't tell their parents as much as they used to, and that's
right.
part of it too. And so as a parent, you may never know what comes of that. But I think you can be confident that, you know, like so many other parts of parenting, you know, you're just trying to help them discover all their own strengths, all their own potentials and abilities and talents, and then off they go, you know, and you trust that you've given them the resources to succeed in life and to you know, enjoy the good things of life and be good to other people and all that. So yeah, it's you know, there's a lot of faith and a lot of you know, kind of trusting in the
mm-hmm.
in the natural process, but also, you know, being active as a parent and in encouraging you know, certain experiences the child might not get encouraged, you know, from other sources
right.
in the culture. So yeah.
And another thing also, it is a wonderful topic conversation starter, because
mm-hmm.
you invoke something that it's from the inside, and if you start off, well, you know, I dream about this, and what did you dream? What do you think about what I dream? And so forth. These are the things that actually helps to build better relationships.
Yeah, yeah. It like you say, it's kind of an easy and sometimes kind of an indirect way of talking
mm-hmm,
about
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, emotional and complicated emotional issues with
mm-hmm.
with children. If you say, oh, you know, tell me how you feel about school, you know, a child
yeah.
will just look at you. Well, I don't know. But if you listen to them tell some dreams, you can kind of pick up on how they're feeling about
right.
school, and
right.
they can communicate that to you in a way that you might not, you know, you might not otherwise have an opportunity to. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's true, because you can only segue to topics that you want to talk about, but certainly the angle comes from the sharing of the dreams.
Yeah. Yeah, and the dreams are so you know, rooted in personal
mm-hmm.
life experiences that
mm-hmm.
you know, like for teachers, you know, who sometimes will offer children free writing assignments, like, you know, write a paragraph about anything you want to write about, and children are often like, I don't know what to write about. I'm bored of all those topics. If you just suggest, well, just hey, maybe write about one of your dreams.
Mm-hmm.
That can just launch them right there, because it's a personal experience. It's something
Precisely.
They know. There's some funny stuff that happens, and
mm-hmm.
there you go. It opens it up for them. So.
And the most important thing is that I'm saying this respectfully, is the current best thinking at that time. It's
right.
pure emotion that you talk about that's being expressed on paper.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I think there's a delight that children feel as they you know, explore the bounds of their own creative imaginations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not something that I could say, you know, raises their test
mm-hmm.
scores
mm-hmm.
or makes them less likely to do X, Y, or Z. But everything we know about child development makes me think that a healthy dream life can only help that
right.
that process. So
wonderful. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Yeah, well, the book is available from our publisher, Roman and Littlefield, and available on any online resource. You know, it's Amazon, Powell's, Barnes & Noble's. It's out there, and you can also find it on my website, which is myname.com, kellybalkley.com. And I also write a
blog for the Huffington Post, so I've written some things about the book and children's dreams for that in the last couple months. And we're always interested to hear from people if they have questions or comments. I'll definitely be mentioning your podcast on my site. This is a great conversation. I'm glad we could talk.
Fantastic. Your book has a very extensive appendix section, and I'm particularly interested in Appendix 4, Activities to Stimulate Wonder in Childhood. Can you share with us some of these activities?
Yeah, sure. Well, this is the notion of wonder is kind of a theme running throughout the book, that children's dreams can enhance or kind of stimulate this sense of wonder that you know many artists say is key to their process, many scientists, many inventors, like to wonder, to feel sort of great amazement and curiosity is a powerful force in human life. And so, you know, working with dreams and reflecting on dreams is one way, but we talk about some others, just real simple things, just, you know, lying or sitting down with your child and just looking up at the clouds and just like talking about the shapes. We talked about water, you know, just like going to a body of water, whether it's a river or an ocean, and just sitting there and just looking at it for a while. We talk about drawing a little map of the solar system, you know, of the planets, of the sun and the earth and some of the other planets, and just kind of looking at that and thinking about that. We talk about making a point of having a good conversation with an elderly person, you know, someone who's you know, on the older end of things, and the child can really, you know, talk about what it's like to be older and at the end of a long, long life. Things like that, you know, that we and we give a bunch of other examples. And that I have to say, my mother was sort of created the master list for that, because she had a really good sense of that as a parent, of ways to just find the sort of the everyday wonders all around us, and just helping your child just like, wow, if you just stand here and look over there, you're getting kind of a window into the universe, just that little whatever it is right over there. And you know, whether it's dreams, whether it's a stream, whether it's a cloud up in the sky, that's what we're talking about.
Fantastic. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Well, a recipe for living, I guess I'd boil it down to a single ingredient, which would be play. And as I said earlier on, we view dreaming as a kind of play. So I think finding the play spirit in one's life, in the various activities that we engage in, even if we're working, there are play elements that we can develop and cultivate. And it's like a, you know, in recipe terms, maybe play is kind of a spice or a condiment or something that can kind of enliven and create kind of an inspirational energy in almost anything we do.
Fantastic. Dr. Buckley, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Melody J. Anderson. She is a celebrity therapist and an expert in such topics as surviving your teen without serving time, understanding addiction and helping those who left the addict, spiritual parenting, and creating healthy boundaries. Melody and I will be discussing about creating healthy boundaries to cope with the second half of 2013 with clarity and optimism. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening. Have a blessed week. Dr. Buckley, thank you again, and have a blessed day, sir.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a wonderful conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.